Hello, everyone, and welcome to Filmstrips, the podcast that remains under quarantine because God only knows, you know, we need to be kept away from people. And that was before the issue of illness was even a factor. I'm Dave Babbitt.
I'm Andrew Kanagieser. Yes. Hello to everybody who is still taking time and bandwidth to listen in to our merry podcast. Hope you're all doing okay at home. It has been yet another crazy week. I think, Dave, just to be safe, let's assume every episode of Film Strips is going to be the last one. And, you know, we'll just be sure to thank everybody when it's over. But I guess before we get to the end, we should probably begin at the beginning. And welcome, if you're joining us for the first time. Dave's about to tell you how it all works.
Yes, this is indeed Filmstrips, the podcast in which each and every episode we talk about a film, we talk about it in depth, we dissect it, we get into the nuance, you know, find out what great deals of thematics are there, explain the symbolism if we so need to. The important thing is that each and every episode must somehow be connected back to the film we discussed the preceding episode. And Andrew, what were we taking a look at last time on this little program of ours?
Last time, we were looking at the film The Thin Man, which, again, our theory that episodes involving the words the and man and T-H-I proved to be well-received, so thank you all for your kind feedback and for tuning in. From that, we decided to follow cinematographer James Wong Howe into 1957 to another black and white film, another dark comedy, one that is very totally different, and one that's heart is truly a cookie full of arsenic. We are looking at Alexander McKendrick's 1957 noir, The Sweet Smell of Success.
Yes, absolutely. Which stars one Burt Lancaster and Tony Curtis. And yeah, this is on one hand, this is a film I'm gonna tip my hat early. I love this movie. I also acknowledge that when we originally scheduled this, we probably weren't considering discussing it under the circumstances we are. So, if this seems, you know, less than ideal,
pulling back the curtain, I know everyone's very tense right now. I know there's a lot of adjustments going on. And Dave and I were just discussing that, yeah, I'm very much of the same mind. This is a very well-made movie. I honestly don't know how many of our listeners will watch the film if they hadn't seen it before, or how they choose to approach it. This is not a good film to watch if you're looking for something uplifted while you and your loved ones are trapped indoors.
The irony is that this is actually available on the Criterion channel right now. For once, we have a film that's easily accessible if you have that particular streaming service. And no, not in this instance. This is probably the one time where it's like, watch this movie eventually.
I've been making do. I bought a used 3DS and spent way more money than I should on old Nintendo 64 games, so the missus can lay on the couch and watch Tiger King, which is a very interesting story, I'll give it that. It's tough figuring out a proper viewing schedule for life under quarantine, but you go to war with the film that you picked, and we're gonna talk about it anyway. But don't worry, everybody, we'll try to keep it light, or at least avoid films like, say, Panic in the Streets, Outbreak.
Basically what I've been watching this week. So
yeah, Spring Breakers, The Andromeda Strain. There's got to be some more. I'm sure we'll come to it. But, The Sweet Smell of Success. Now, that is one of those films that, as we'll get into, can be forgiven for not being at the forefront of everybody's radar, the same way that other films such as Streetcar Named Desire from the same period or On the Waterfront are. And not just because, you know, they were made by people who cooperated with HUAC, but, I mean, Sweet Smell of Success, despite the distinctiveness of that title, I feel like people know the title, but they don't know the movie itself. And I think that's a perfect segue for Dave to give us the rundown.
Sweet Smell of Success is Alexander McKendrick's 1957 drama, starring Tony Curtis and Burt Lancaster. Written by Ernest Lehman and Clifford Odets, the film's the story of Sidney Falco, a press agent who, in an effort to preserve his professional relationship with powerful New York Gotham columnist J.J. Hunsaker, sets about destroying the romantic relationship between Hunsaker's sister and her jazz musician boyfriend, a critical and financial flop upon original release, the film has undergone a critical reevaluation over the years, often being heralded as one of the best Hollywood films of the 1950s. Coming up after film strips, everyone feels uncomfortable when Wings Hauser is a celebrity contestant on Body Language.
Alright, so, The Sweet Smell of Success. Even from the opening credits to this film, there's a number of pretty big names attached to it. Notably, I mean, you have a score being done by Elmer Bernstein, who, again, his name does not indicate he would be so good at making, like, jazzy big band scores. I just picture, like, a construction worker in the Midwest, you know, punching a clock or something, and then going home and listening to Hank Williams or something.
Well, this is the thing. This is a film that ends up attracting a bucket load of talent at, in many instances, relatively near the start of their careers. But,
well, yeah, because in addition to Bernstein, we also, as we said, have cinematography by James Wong Howe, who, again, well-celebrated and one of the first prolific and highly celebrated Asian cinematographers working in Hollywood. But you also have a script that has work done by Ernest Lehman and Clifford Odets, who are not... they're not marquee names, but, I mean, they are notable figures in the creative arts. And, yeah, and, I mean, least among which, you've also got Burt Lancaster and Tony Curtis on top of this, so it's immediately on paper. It's like, how can this film miss?
Well, and it depends upon how you define miss, because, yeah, with the audience of the time back in 1957, this thing was poorly reviewed and was a box office bomb. Mainly because it was so pitch black that it was not well received.
Yeah, and like there are anecdotal stories about Lancaster, whose own production company funded the film and basically got it made, how even on the opening night screening that everybody in attendance was just like, well, we all just lost our money.
Well, which brings us to basically backing up and, I guess, describing the origins of this film, because it...
Yes, so now that you know that it's a grim film that kind of went wrong, let's rewind to what went wrong.
So, sort of, let's go back to the 1950s, or early part of the 1950s, and particularly starting with Ernest Lehman. Now... at the time, he was working for, in the late 1940s, at one point, for Walter Winchell. Now, for those who don't know him, he was a major columnist operating out of New York back in the throughout the 30s and 40s and into the 1950s.
Yeah, sort of like a Will Rogers type figure.
Sort of, but definitely a very powerful voice that could basically cohorted with presidents and other individuals, such as, namely, J. Edgar Hoover. And he was known as effectively a man who could destroy people and did so on a frequent basis.
Well, I mean, what white man in power didn't at the time?
Well, like I said, he had a notorious reputation for doing it, certainly. And basically, Liam worked...
It's just weird because I have no awareness of who Walter Winchell is. It's a name I've heard, but, like, I've never read his work. I don't know a lot about him. So, this film is kind of weird because it feels like, on the one hand, the character that's sort of the substitution, the Winchell figure. I feel like a lot of details were supposed to come into the film just kind of knowing, based on our knowledge of Walter Winchell, that the film never explains. But that's kind of something to get into later. Do you know anything about Walter Winchell beyond evil columnist with massive influence?
Well, he was somebody who, in many ways, he, like, again, was a bit of a power broker. He is somebody who operated on his whims, was considered a mostly associated with the tabloids. But again, he worked with individuals in political power, he had connections with show business, and he was also somebody who basically policed his daughter's relationships with men very extensively in a very possessive way. Keep that in mind, folks. The important thing is, Liam basically takes his all-too-brief time working for Winchell and ends up writing up a small novelette originally published in Cosmopolitan in April of 1950 under the title of Tell Me About It Tomorrow, even though his original title for that one was Sweet Smell of Success.
Yeah, now apparently they weren't allowed to use it because there was a ban on printing the word smell?
Yeah, apparently, yeah. One of the editors at the magazine refused to allow the word smell as a title to be used in association with anything, figuring it was off-putting and repellent.
Yeah, so last week we were talking about the Thin Man and the onset of the Hays Code and Hollywood's attempts to self-police itself. And yeah, we've gone from, he never got anywhere near my tabloids, and what, 20-odd years later, you can't say smell in print. Now, of course, we are maybe an interesting point of distinction, also comparing what we see in The Sweet Smell of Success to The Thin Man, is we have one film at the onset of the code, and this one we have closer to the end of the code. I mean, the story of the code losing its power can't necessarily be attributed to, like, one specific moment, but there are a couple films, like this one, like Kiss Me Deadly, like Man with the Golden Arm, The Moon is Blue, that start doing more controversial material, but handling it tastefully enough that opinion starts to waver, and eventually, like, parallel groups like the Board of Decency and things like that are like, well, sure, Man with the Golden Arm, Frank Sinatra's a junkie, and his wife is faking a wheelchair illness, and Darren McGavin is a hustler who gets murdered. It's bananas. Go watch it. It's tremendous. But the thing is, the film is not exploitative in its treatment, so there's less pressure to apply the code as rigorously, and we see kind of like a deeper dive in noir territory into just how seedy the underbelly can get.
Well, absolutely, and it's worth noting this is also the point where many European films are starting to hit the art circuit crowd, which are really pushing the envelope on things that audiences can see, and yes, there was a point in time where the art house crowd was sizable enough that it was influential on what was going on in terms of American cinemas, because they weren't expected to follow the American production code at the time, and over the next 10 years, about the mid to late 50s into the 1960s, we see that power dwindle as more and more people, particularly counterculture, really starts to push back on that. Putting that aside, though, the main thing is that Liam goes on to have to establish himself in Hollywood as one of the go-to screenwriters of the time. And certainly over time, I mean, he would achieve a wide number of credits, writing films such as Sabrina, the Humphrey Bogart, and I believe it's Audrey Hepburn classic, North by Northwest, a.k.a. one of the greatest films Hitchcock ever did, and of course, West Side Story that Steven Spielberg is currently remaking for reasons that I cannot even begin to fathom.
Wait, really? I've been too busy yelling at people on Twitter and establishing a little side action, DM for deets. Yeah, I missed out on Spielberg remaking West Side Story.
Yeah, apparently he's hell-bent on ending his career on his terms, which basically means nobody showing up to see what he's doing.
Why? What are they going to do for West Side Story in 2020? It's like, instead of sharks and jets, it's like breeders and incels? Like, what is the purpose in remaking that story now? And what are they going to do about the fact that it's predicated on a racial divide?
Well, we shall see. God only knows. Point being that,
well,
yeah,
I'm sure that the white dude is gonna show us how it's done.
Point is that Liam ends basically just creates himself a really sizable role in Hollywood. And like many a screenwriter, he has eyes on the one job that he doesn't quite have as a screenwriter. Directing. Because as we all know, that's where the real power is. And, well, yeah, he sets about wanting to do this. Now, let's cut to later on in the 1950s. Burt Lancaster has firmly established himself in Hollywood. He's established his own production company by this point in time, Hench, Hill, and Lancaster.
Yeah, and it's so interesting to think about just, like, Burt Lancaster. I'll freely admit I don't know a whole lot about him offhand, in that I haven't seen, like, every single Burt Lancaster film or anything, but, like, he made his screen debut in 1946 in Robert Siodmak's The Killers, which is also a great film, but He's making this film 11 years later as one of the producers. Like, his name, Lancaster, comes up first because it's his production company. But also, this company, like, in its nascent stages, formed in 1948. So what that means is 2 years after his on-screen debut, Burt Lancaster has his own production company, and this is all in place before he ends up being in films like From Here to Eternity. So, like, when you think about the fact that studio power through the 50s, post the Supreme Court decision in Paramount that breaks up the monopoly of the big studio system, to think about Burt Lancaster, of all people, being in a position of such weird power, it's very surprising, and it's not something I expected to learn.
Well, yeah, and I mean, it's certainly worth keeping in mind the idea of separate production companies from the studios, because prior to basically the late 40s, early 1950s, the studios were pretty much in charge of everything. You know, they would have their script departments, they would develop them, they would shoot them on their lots with their studio crews who were all under contract. Like, everything was kept in-house. Once the Paramount decrees happen, it becomes much more financially difficult to continue justifying that expense. So production companies end up basically being these companies that more or less partner with studios in developing and working on stuff and sharing costs to effectively mitigate things. But this does provide the opportunity for certain individuals to basically play, you know, make power plays and start getting a greater sense of control over what they're doing.
Well, yeah, because Dave, like, as a modern example, Disney Pixar, because Pixar is now currently owned by Disney. But I don't believe that was always the case.
It was started by George Lucas, actually, in the 1980s, and eventually was an independent company, a production company that, yes, partnered with Disney on their early releases before being bought and brought in-house by Disney. But you see this all the time with other companies such as, again, many of you have heard of Legendary Pictures and have seen their logo before tons of films. Well, that's a production company that has agreements in place with places like Warner Brothers and Universal and was pretty much co-financing or producing films for those companies using properties that they owned, but that were now being seen by them, overseen by them. So it's a complicated factor. It's always sometimes a little bit hard without having all access to the details to see how this financing structure would break down. But the important thing is that, yes, by this point in time, this production company is on its own and it's developing productions, particularly for United Artists, which at this point in time is still an independent studio, one of the mini majors, separate from MGM long before it was bought up by them.
Yeah, and this is pre-Heaven's Gate too, right?
Long before Heaven's Gate. Kidding. Yeah.
Shed a tear, pour one out for everyone involved. I actually wear a black armband to celebrate Heaven's Gate awareness.
Oh boy. Putting that aside, the key thing here is that they take an interest in Liam's original novelette, The Sweet Smell of Success, and want to turn it into a film. Now, here's where things get a little complicated in terms of who you want to believe, because there are competing stories here. The one story that's offhand that's put out is that Liam, you know, wanted to both write and direct this film, and that he was promised this by the production company in order to do so. Now, in one hand, what ends up happening here is that, quote-unquote, UA gets cold feet and doesn't want Liam directing because they want a surer hand at control of a movie of this size and scale with this kind of power behind it.
Well, also, it goes without saying that every studio wants a film to be successful, but as we've talked about in previous episodes, like, the 1950s is kind of one of those hinge points for the industry, because we're saying that they're moving away to a different mode of production, and that's also because there's no guaranteed ownership of film distribution anymore. Like, a film can't guarantee that they own a chain of theaters that they can flood the market with. So, and also television is starting to eat into filmic budgets as well. So there is that balancing act where we need to make films spectacular enough that it's beyond what TV can do, but it can't be so lavish that we can be frivolous in assuming risk.
Yeah, now, in this instance, if we go with this version of the story, Liam steps aside willingly or not, and Alexander McKendrick is brought in. Now, McKendrick was somebody who was actually a British filmmaker who had spent his long time working at Ealing Studios, directing films such as The Lady Killers from 1955. Problem was, Ealing basically went under and was bought up by the BBC, and he was at risk of finding himself without a work. So after entertaining numerous offers across Hollywood, he ended up signing up with Burt Lancaster's production company under the assumption that he might get to do one of his dream projects, an adaptation of George Bernard Shaw's The Devil's Disciple as a film. A project which quickly fell apart. He wanted to get out of his contract from them, and instead they assigned him to do this movie. And from this point forward, Liam gets ill, quote-unquote, and then Clifford Odets is brought in to complete the script work at this.
Yes, good old Clifford Odets, who we have not covered his work, but anecdotally, as we discussed in our Barton Fink episode, it is generally assumed that Odets was not just the aesthetic, but also the behavioral model of John Turturro's character.
Well, we should also know that we may have covered him previously on the podcast as well, because he did supposedly do uncredited work on two script films we've covered, Notorious and Bigger Than Life.
Wait, we did Notorious?
Suspicion. We did Suspicion, not Notorious. So we did cover Bigger Than Life, though, which we both loved. Other films that maybe not suited for quarantine viewing. But putting that aside...
He's taking, what is it? Cortisone.
Yeah.
Not chloroquinine. That's the one that people think is going to make them better instead of kill them, because people are not listening to doctors. Okay. Listen to health professionals, everyone. Be safe and be sensible. Back to the movie.
Yes, so basically, Odets, we'll get into him in a second, but the key thing is here, that's the sort of sanitized version. Liam gets sick, he's gone, Odets gets brought in. The other version of events, if you choose to believe it, was that Liam was brought in and told that, yes, you would be allowed to write the script
Dave,
and direct.
I love you to pieces, but you keep saying Lehman or Liam, and I think it's Layman.
Layman, sorry. But in the case of Layman here, he was basically offered that, yes, you could come in and work on the screenplay and direct, but that the production company had no intention of ever letting him direct the film.
Yeah, the old Orson Welles contract.
Yeah, basically, he gets hired, he starts writing his drafts of the script, and then discovers that, no, they had no intention of allowing me to direct this movie, and quits in basically fury, and then Odets is brought on. Which one is true? Well, a little hard to tell. Neither here nor there. The important thing that we need to know is that Lemon is out, and in this case, Odets is in, McKendrick's in, and then it comes time to start casting this movie. So, for this point, this brings us to our major individuals, which is Burt Lancaster, who naturally was going to be sort of in the film in some component here, who gets cast in the Walter Winchell role of J.J. Hunsaker there. And we'll get into the plot of the film.
Yeah, now do you know if that's supposed to be a reference to the Coen Brothers or the Coen Brothers Hunsaker proxy? Do you know if that's supposed to be an allusion?
I have no idea whether that's intended to be sort of a reference to that or not. I mean, it could be.
Hunsaker the Coen proxy is... it's one of those Coen brother films that everyone just forgot about.
Which is a shame.
Sort of like happens between everything else. Like, one day they're going to release like a box set that'll take up an entire shelf. And then everyone's going to realize how many gems we had in front of us all this time.
Well, absolutely. And it was the first of three collaborations. It's the second that the Coen brothers did that involved Bruce Campbell. So don't forget that, folks. It's very important that you know that for some reason.
Yeah, you might be on Jeopardy one day.
Yeah, exactly. Probably not with Alex Trebek. But putting that aside, what ends up happening here is it then comes time to decide who's going to be playing really what is the lead character of this film, Sidney Falco. And the person who is hell-bent on getting this role is actually a Universal Pictures contract player of the time, Tony Curtis. Now, it's hard to say, I don't know how many people in this day and age who aren't classic film fans really know who Tony Curtis is compared to guys like Burt Lancaster.
Was it True Hollywood Story he hosted?
I'm not sure if he did or not.
Always him. He was definitely the host of one of those shows where it's always like the intro is him standing in high beams on a foggy night in like an LA parking lot wearing a trench coat. And he's like, Betty Davis captured our hearts. But what America didn't know is that she too had one that was broken. And, like, then it would talk about some time that she, you know, had to pull a knife on Buddy Ebsen or something. But, yeah, I think Tony Curtis, looking back, probably most famous for either the Odd Couple or Some Like It Hot.
He's not in The Odd Couple, but he was...
Wait, isn't he in one of them? Oh, crap. I'm thinking of Tony Randall.
Yeah.
Yeah, Some Like It Hot, though, he is in.
Yeah.
And that's what I remember him from.
Probably most do. He's also probably most famous, I think, for contemporary audiences as being the dad of Jamie Lee Curtis there. So, in this instance...
Oh, yeah. That's why they have the same eyebrows.
Yeah. The important thing is that Tony Curtis, at this point in time, was basically known for what many people call his baby-faced roles. He's a young actor, he's got sort of that handsome look to himself, but he has that youthful pluckiness to him, and he is usually playing likable guys on screen at this point.
Well, he's got that Sinatra kind of, like, 50s charm that, like, just audiences couldn't get enough of. Some guy with, like, a curly pompadour going, I grew up on the rough side, but I'm trying to do good.
But he also had a very large, you know, teenage fan base. We can't overlook that as well. I mean,
I thought you were going somewhere else with that. Now you're thinking of Gary Cooper.
No. But in this instance, yeah, Tony Curtis was popular, but he was somebody who wanted to break out of the sort of pigeonholed status that he was in. Kind of like Frank Sinatra early in his career, who, it's hard to think about it now, but there was a point where he was just considered a teeny bopper idol and nobody took him seriously. He had to work his butt off to get people to realize, no, I am an adult performer, take me seriously, damn it. And
yeah, being friends with the Kennedy family and organized crime probably helped a little, but we'll get to Sinatra one day.
Yeah, point being here that Curtis basically... fought like hell to get the role of Sidney Falco, basically viewing it as the complete opposite of everything he had done up to that point. And boy, is that correct, as we'll get into. And this was something Universal Studios, who was in the position to lend him out for this movie, really wasn't sure about, because they figured it might damage him as a box office star for their company. And again, well,
yeah. It's like in wrestling where a guy will loan out one of their big stars to another company to work a couple matches, but they're like, well, no, if we're doing that, we're not having the guy lose in 30 seconds to your guy, because then he's useless when he comes back.
Yeah, but ultimately they end up, I'm not sure how they convinced anybody to let him in, or whether it was Curtis himself, or whether it was Lancaster's doing, or McKendrick, but somehow they do end up getting Tony Curtis signed on to appear in this film and shoot it. The rest of the cast starts filling up from this point forward. We get a up-and-coming actress being introduced here, and that is Susan... She plays Susan Hunsucker in here, but her actual name is...
Her actual name. Oh, how could we forget her?
Susan Harrison.
Yes. Introducing Susan Harrison, no? Which is, and this proves to be one of two screen credits.
Yeah, she did, but we'll get into her performance in a bit, but she's introduced here playing the role of J.J. Hunsucker's younger sister, notably altering it from the wind chill.
Also named Susan.
So hence the confusion here, folks. Sorry. We end up getting a few classics like Sam Levine, sort of working character actors in a few roles. Barbara Nichols is Rita, and probably in one of the strangest casting things, which, again, not sure if this is true or not, but apparently for one of the central roles of Steve Dallas, they originally wanted a young Robert Vaughn to appear in this.
Oh, that would have been great.
Yeah, unfortunately.
He would still look like he was 60.
Well, yes, but it turns out he ended up getting supposedly drafted before he was able to shoot this.
I'm like, into what? Because wasn't Korea over by 57?
I'm not 100% certain which, this is where I'm a little bit questioning the likelihood of that, but I'm just going with the story I've heard. Take that one with a grain of salt. Either way, the role of Steve Dallas ends up getting played by Martin Milner, eventually a television staple starting in the 60s and 70s, but here cast in what can only be said as, well, probably the weak point in the film, sort of. I mean, it works in the film's favor, but...
And I mean, again, like, this is, I feel like, The Thin Man, where... We're spending a lot of time on background, but that's because I think the film we get is remarkably straightforward and linear, And in a lot of ways, I think that's owing to the influence of particularly Layman and Odette and their sort of more stage background coming to the film. Like, there's something that feels very play-esque about not just the structuring of the film, but also the dialogue and, like, the staging of interior scenes in that. And that's not a criticism, mind you, but, like, it feels like a very tight and focused film that has maybe one central thesis that it keeps hammering, and it does so effectively. But, like, honestly, I think much of the grist of this film is just how insane things got and how everything kept going wrong.
Well, the thing about it is, I mean, when we get right down to it, I mean, this is a film that, you're right, on one hand, it's very accessible and easy to get into it. But in terms of the points it's making and in terms of the targets it's hitting about American culture at this point in time, this is following very quickly on the heels of basically the end of McCarthyism at that point in time, and where really that sort of disillusionment with the American government and its actions is starting to seep in. This is not, you know, post-Watergate levels of disillusionment, but certainly this is a film that is much more on the much more bitter, negative, black-hearted side about American culture.
Yeah, because we saw films like Mirage and other films like Bigger Than Life that that do sort of, they definitely have fangs out for trends they see in society. I remember we argued a lot about Mirage, whether or not the film is ultimately critical or celebratory of American society. This is a film that I think deals with similar themes, but it also makes it very clear at all times that it is critical.
Well, and that's the thing. This is a film that, and again, I can see why audiences, if they were looking for something optimistic in the midst of nuclear crises that were coming.
We need something to tide us over while Robert Vaughn goes to war.
And instead we end up with, yeah, a film that is basically, and this is why all of society is horrible. From the
Hey guys, remember when you could trust journalists? Well, I've got the film for you. Yeah, it is a bleak film, and perhaps the stage is set for us to get down to it. Because even though Lancaster is sort of the big figure and one of the main driving forces, I don't think it's accurate to really say that he is the star of the show.
Well, no. This is a film that, I mean, if anything, this is Tony Curtis's movie. And not to get to dive too much into his performance right off the bat, but it's worth noting, you can tell he is eating into this at every single moment. He is going to make this film count. And thank God for it, because his performance is a stunner in this film, carrying you throughout it. But yes, this does, yes, open up the film, which is, yes, The Sweet Smell of Success. And we open with these opening credits that basically are giving us a look at contemporary New York that was shot on location, as we see effectively things such as the, I guess it was the actual loading docks of the New York Times, doubling for,
yeah,
what is,
like, printing off, rolling out newspapers, and then we get the credits over one of the delivery trucks just driving through New York.
Yeah.
And it's just a slow tracking shot, and again, though, like, we can immediately see some similarities to The Thin Man, because you have that starkly contrasted black and white, because it's pitch dark, but there's so much reflective light bouncing around in urban space, like, comes out beautifully, and you also get that mobility of the shot as well.
Oh yeah, and you can tell in the, at this point in time, this is about 23 years since the making of The Thin Man, James Wong Howe has just gotten that much better at his craft, and it shows on screen in every single frame of it. And
yeah, and it sets a very good energy for the film. Like, it's on an affective level, like, it's an opening that really sets the film up to have a certain momentum. And to the film's credit, it does sustain that momentum, because even though the actual plot of the film is relatively uncomplicated, like, it does move.
Oh, God, yeah. And our opening, the first character we're introduced to here is Sidney Falco, played by Tony Curtis. And we find him buying a newspaper, seemingly in a rush. And again, he flips through it, looks for things, finds one column written by J.J. Hunsucker, played again by Burt Lancaster, but we only see his photograph at this point in time. He quickly scans it, looks disappointed or frustrated, and then tosses out a newspaper. Because, yes, this is back in a time when newspapers were dirt cheap to get your hands on here, folks.
Yes, and this is the early edition. And then he storms back to the office, and then we learn, this is here where we learn that, okay, Hunsaker is the prominent critic. We learn that Sidney is... Basically, he's like a talent agent, more or less.
He's a press agent, right? Yeah, and his job effectively is, he's supposed to be the person who plants stories, get publicity for his clients, and is supposed to be connected to the people who have the platform that he can whisper in their ear and get them, get his clients noticed.
He's like a proto Nightcrawler.
Yeah.
You know, just before you could upload everything on FTP and kill Bill Paxton.
But the kid...
Because he's basically trawling around, like, asking favors and trying to grease the wheels. So his stars will get mentioned and get roles, and he gets a cut of it, right?
Well, and not just get, you know, his stars, but he works for, you know, clubs in the city. Basically, anybody who wants to get some their eyes in their place, he will work for. But what I love about the shot is he basically wanders back into his office. We get some very clever, very smart work, which quickly establishes some of the themes and ideas that are going to run throughout this film, where his secretary is basically, you know, starts acknowledging that, look, somebody's been trying to reach you about something. He's been calling you multiple times, and he wants nothing to do with it because he knows exactly what the guy's calling about, which is that there was no mention in Hunsaker's column that he basically promised was going to happen. But we then see Tony Curtis walks to his door, opens it, and instead of walking into his office, like you would assume, it's his back bedroom. There is no divide between his personal and professional life at this point. And that's a very key and important thing that's going to recur throughout this film, where the idea of personal and professional boundaries and ideas do not exist in this world at all. Anything that's there is at the best a slight filter between them. And we will see Sidney use and abuse that notion throughout the film.
Well, yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, but does Sidney ever actually sleep in this film?
Not that we can really see, at least that's on camera, but yeah.
Yeah, like, clearly some time has to go by, but, like, the way it's put together, it is also seamless. Like, it seems like, yeah, everything about Sidney, and especially his mannerisms and, like, that energy he brings, like, it's a happy accident that they ended up having him get shot by James Long Howe, because it gives you the sense that, like, he just shoved a handful of Benzedrine in your mouth and was like, all right, kid, let's go to work. And we're just tracking him through, like, this urban morass.
Well, Sidney is a shark in basically every way that counts. That whole idea of if you don't keep moving, you die is basically the way to define him.
In that opening, he also explains to the secretary, she's asking, like, why he cares so much about Hunsaker. And he's saying, because that's my ticket on the ride up. And he gives a very theatrically structured monologue, but, like, he's very physical in his performance, and it gives us that great line that only the best is good enough for me.
Well, absolutely. And we also, when she questions about why Hunsaker has it out for him, you know, he goes through a series of justifications, like, why does he do anything? You know, it's whims. It's all about whims. And then finally, basically points out, it's like, you know, I thought I did something for him. Evidently, it didn't go through.
Yes. And that's the real crux of this film.
Well,
and, I mean, that's a great opening, though, because you're right, aesthetically and figuratively, it clearly establishes all we need to know about Sidney, and it also drops the hook that's going to be the main plot of the film.
Well, absolutely, because this is a story that's happening in media res, where he is already having to deal with the consequences of this. And for the next little bit, we see him dealing with a very dissatisfied client who basically is, you know, again, and I love the phone call between him and the owner of the club, who's basically playing, Sidney, you're a liar. Don't get me wrong, that's exactly why I hired you, but now you're lying to me.
Because he calls him out. He's like, I'm not lying to you. He's like, don't treat me like I'm stupid. It's fine. It's what you do. But don't do it to me.
Exactly. And Sidney is basically frustrated as all hell, and his decision is saying, okay, I gotta go, I gotta find out what's going on. I gotta go visit my uncle's club and basically check in on the situation. And the situation is that basically, what's happened is Hunsaker has a sister in this incident, rather than Winchell's actual daughter. And what JJ wants and tasked Sydney to do was basically break up her relationship with Steve Dallas, who is a
who is the guitarist for is it Chico Hamilton's
jazz band? And let's be clear, Chico Hamilton's quintet is actually a real band of the time. This was not a fictional group, and I always love it when you have real groups and then suddenly there's this fictional member that's been shoved in, and it's very clear when you see Martin Milner in this film that he does not fit with this group whatsoever.
It's like, one of these things is not like the other. I wonder what it might be. It's like the Chris Isaac show. It was his real band, but they also added a member that was an actor. Or it's like the Blasters in the Blasters in Streets of Fire, where I like to imagine that they are diegetically also a member of the Bombers. You can have a lot of fun with that, but so Steve, though, you know, he seems like a nice guy. Again, he is very similar to Dorothy's partner in The Thin Man, where he's just clean-cut, nice guy, heart's in the right place, but he is held to be beneath Susan's standing, and JJ wants to split them up.
Well, standing might be one of the issues. It depends upon exactly how much we want to read into JJ's real motivations, but we'll get there.
The reason JJ gives is that Steve is not good enough for her through the course of the film. It establishes the nuances of his opinion of his sister.
Yeah, and we'll get into that in depth in plenty of time, folks, trust me. But the important thing is, Sydney shows up, the band's playing, he starts grilling one of the cigarette girls, Rita, about basically what went on and what, has he seen or she seen Susan around lately. And she's not sure. And it's very quickly established that clearly Sydney has a relationship of some sort with her. And that she is currently at risk because a columnist at another club that she's at risk of losing her job at, basically, he decided to get handsy with her basically at an apartment. And she kicked him out, or she walked out on him after physically forcing him off her. And now she doesn't know what to do. Sydney's not really listening. And I love Tony Curtis's performance where he's absorbing information and not really giving a damn at the same time.
Well, yeah, because what is it that she says to him? It's like, hey, eyebrows, don't you return messages? And, like, also, the dialogue throughout this film is all written in that same style. I mean, the same way that, you know, the club owner and Sydney, how there's that knowing understanding between everybody. It's like in James Ellroy novels where, like, everyone is opposed in interest, but they all kind of work together because they understand that this is the life and this is how these things go.
Well, precisely. So after basically promising her, he'll look into seeing what he can do for her to protect her job, he goes and sees his uncle, Frank, who is in charge of the club. And it's pretty quickly established in the banter between the two that Frank doesn't think much of Sydney, and Sydney doesn't think much of Frank either.
Yeah, I forgot by the end of the film that Frank is Sydney's uncle.
Yeah, it's one of those things, it's a small detail, and it really makes the relationship, the dynamic of it, all the more interesting as you're following it. But basically, he starts, grilling, it's like, what happened to Susan? What's going on? And Frank's opinion is like, well, they are quote-unquote broken up, and I'm happy about that, but not for the reasons you are, Sydney. I mean, I want to look after this guy's future. He's got a great career ahead of himself. And it's very clear they're establishing, Frank is like the good.
Yeah, it's like, he's a great guitarist, and he'll make hot jazz safe for white America.
Well, yeah.
Can't miss. Rock and roll lives on.
Yeah, so while Sydney, basically, the band gets done, they go backstage, Sydney's starts wanting to, before he gets back there, though, Steve notices that Susan Hunsaker is outside, and basically asks for the band to cover for him while he goes speaks to her out there. Sydney, sure enough, comes back, and they give him the brush off, saying, oh, we think we saw him go upstairs, and he goes checking out. Which leads us to the forbidden romance between Susan and Dallas, and it's interesting because, here's the thing. I think Susan Howard, or Harrison, He's actually a really good actor in this film, and I like her performance, but she's effectively asked to play a very meek individual who's used to being under the thumbs of her strong-arm brother.
It's very much like a face in the crowd in more than one respect, but one thing that does unite is, like, our central female character gives a great performance, but it's a character that's written to be in a position of submission for about 98% of the film.
Well, yes. And it's very clear when dealing with Steve that despite the fact that, you know, again, Milner is not the most dynamic screen presence, he does sell the idea of being the good-natured, you know, square-jawed authoritarian, or at least, you know, hothead that he's supposed to play. And by the end of their discussion, they are engaged to be married, only for Sydney to finally wander in. And again, I love Tony Curtis in the scene as he's acting, you know, rings around Milner at every given moment, as it's very clear Dallas doesn't like him at this point. He doesn't trust him. But it's also clear that Sydney has some relationship with the sister where she trusts him naively just enough to let him in on things.
Yeah, she understands that Sydney is somehow, like, basically in the employ of her brother.
Yeah.
And, you know, because then very soon we see what the contours of Sydney and JJ's relationship is, and they are definitely not held as equals.
But yeah, but basically she agrees to take a car ride with him back, where he effectively is just trying to grill her for information and trying to explain, you know, basically talking up her brother as, you don't need to be worried about him. Everything will be fine. You'll understand. He's much more understanding than you give him credit for, Susan.
Oh, also, did we forget to mention that Steve and Susan, they're planning to get married, right?
Yeah.
Because they're going to tell him at breakfast.
Well, and that's the big thing. Yeah, they are engaged and she is planning to tell her brother at breakfast. And we do, this is probably one of the few moments in the film where we get the sense that maybe there is a marginal bit of humanity to Sydney at this point. Very, very marginal. But there is something where he at least looks in on Susan and realizes, yeah, she actually does love this guy, but I'm still going to do my job.
Yeah, it's a fine balance that has to be walked, yeah. And I see why Universal would be hesitant to let Tony Curtis do it, because Sydney is our lens through the film, and he is, in many ways, the protagonist of this film, or at least the central character, and, you know, that's one moment, and certainly at the ending, there's another moment where he ends up making the, quote-unquote, the right choice, or the moral choice. But at the same time, like, this is a film that plays with that balance in interesting ways, because throughout the rest of it, like, we see Sydney totally fine with making immoral decisions out of necessity. But he's kind of held out as, like, one of the least worst ones in this world.
But only marginally, and by the end, that doesn't really matter.
He's not a hero, even though he does less bad things than the people around him.
Well, it's the thing. He is a horrible person, but he is fascinating. And this is the kind of balance that I think a lot of films miss. It's not that your character, lead character, has to be likable. And many people feel that you have to make your lead character likable. Sydney's not likable, but he is fascinating to watch as he tries to navigate this world and make things work for him. And basically,
his motivation is simply to succeed.
Well, exactly.
And, like, when your goal is that amorphous, it's like, you know, it sort of begs the question of, like, how this life itself becomes kind of a rush for him in a way. And it's like, he's addicted to the hustle of it.
Well, exactly. And sure enough, after him and Susan part, he makes his way to another restaurant / club to finally meet JJ. And this is about 20 minutes into this film at this point.
Yeah, and we're talking like a film that runs just over 90.
Yeah, this is 96 minutes in length, and we haven't even seen Burt Lancaster proper yet in this film. But sure enough, JJ walks into the restaurant, gets fired by one of the clients who has been trying to reach him all day. And sure enough, the first thing after getting told by one of the restaurant's employees that, yes, JJ's in there, he's got a senator, a starlet, and a hanger-on basically with him, he goes and makes a phone call to Sydney from the other room, trying to get his attention for a few moments, where, well, JJ brushes him off completely, and this leads to finally Tony Curtis wandering into the scene and more or less forcing himself into being in JJ's vicinity.
Yeah, and also the way it's framed, you have Lancaster sitting in the foreground dominating the frame, and then you have Tony Curtis, who up until this point was very much positioned as like the alpha dog of the film. We see him in the background, so it's almost like he's the parrot on the shoulder while he's trying to make himself be heard. And yeah, that is what our introduction to the scene is, and you are right, Lancaster is, it's like one of the, not even a bravura performance, a force of nature performance. Like, he is like Ned Beatty in Network without ever having to raise his voice.
Well, that's the thing. Like, I mean, he is a force in this film, but he never overplays his scenes. He is, like, just calm and rational throughout the most of it. And even when he becomes unhinged, it's not to that theatrical degree. He is still...
Yeah, he's J.J. Hunsaker, not J.J. Jameson, right?
Exactly. But basically, he keeps trying to brush away Sydney or humiliate him in front of his guests there. Up until Sydney basically points out that he's got news about his sister. And we then see, like, this absolutely gobsmackingly written and performed series of questions and answers back and forth between the guests, where JJ is simultaneously pointing out what a multi-faced tool Sydney is, insulting him in front of all these people, and also pointing out to the senator, do you realize who you're hanging out with? Do you realize how vulnerable you've made yourself with these two individuals that you brought to my table out in public? And we see him basically play all his power, all while there's this bloody phone in front of him at the table.
There's a great line where it's, are you threatening me? No, I don't threaten my friends.
Yeah, and it's, oh god, it is, the icing on the cake in the scene is just delicious as everybody leaves and the senator finally just gets up and thanks JJ for the help he's provided as he finally dawns on him what's actually going on and who these people are.
Well, yeah, because one of the really interesting things, especially about Lancaster's choice to play the performance so subdued, is that JJ's power is only ever, like, sort of alluded to, so you get, like, you only get glimpses of what this man must know and how well connected he must be.
Yeah.
And again, like, we never feel sympathy for JJ as a character in ways that we might for Sydney, but again, he is still a fascinating character in that, yeah, we don't learn a lot, but he holds our attention.
And we see them exit the club, and before we even get to see Sydney and Hunsaker actually talk about the news about Susan, they run into one of Hunsaker's biggest informants and most powerful allies. Basically a police detective in this instance, by the name of Kello, played by Emil Mayer. Detective Kello, played by Emil Mayer, who in this instance is basically a cop that is strongly implied Hunsaker helped out a long time ago effectively escape a charge of beating a man to death while in his custody, and that he doesn't forget his friends. And it's very apparently this was influenced by Winchell and Hoover's relationship in particular as to how they operate.
I did encounter that. He basically is the greatest on-screen dirty cop since William Hootkin in Tim Burton's Batman. But yeah, also about the exact same level of skin moisture.
Yeah.
He's one of those guys that, like, he just sort of shows up periodically in the film, more or less to just, as he says to Sydney, come back here, I'm not done chastising you. I think the archetype for him is a ball buster, but also a very dangerous one.
Well, absolutely. And his role would become very important as we get to the end of the film. But here, it's just, again, it gives you that sense of exactly how well-connected JJ is and just how interconnected, again, all these things are. There is no distinction between politics, the law, entertainment, the media. Like, it's all blended together in this very disturbing nature. And again, none of it is clean.
Yeah, and I mean, that's what I like about this film, and that's the same way that I like how it's presented in James Ellroy's novels, where it's like, there's that sense of the underworld, and that people can sort of float in and out and keep some of their hands clean, and just this entire like parallel power structure going on in society. And I mean, I can see that being a very unpleasant idea for 1957 audiences who thought, hey, that cute Tony Curtis boy's in a new movie.
Well, yeah. But the important thing is that basically Sidney finally drops the bomb on JJ, where he points out that, look, Susan and that, yeah, I didn't manage to break them up, but Susan and Steve are going to get married. She's planning to tell you at breakfast tomorrow, but I've got a plan that's going to get this all worked out for us in the grand scheme of things. And it leads to probably what might just be the best damn line in this movie. When finally Hunsaker agrees to let Tony, or to let Sidney go through with his plan, and to give him a bit of a break on his clients getting mentioned in his column, where when he asks basically Steve, you know, are you sure this is going to work? And Sidney replies, the cat's in the bag and the bag's in the river. And
yes.
Oh my God.
Oh man. Yeah. That's the Venn diagram, the sweet spot between noir hard-nosed pulp dialogue and New York literati playwright dialogue.
Yeah.
It's, it is impossible to hear that. Not go, oh! Like I actually punched the,
as one should.
Yes, so, I'm just trying to think, because again, like, this is a film that gives all of its scenes a lot of time to breathe.
Yeah.
And I think, again, that's why this film gives a much more theatrical structure than certain narratives we've encountered lately.
Yeah.
But they end up working up this somewhat convoluted plan, though, where they are going to plant an item that suggests that Steve is a marijuana-smoking communist, and then Hunsaker is basically going to step in, offer to quash that story, so Steve's going to owe him one.
Right? And, of course, because Steve is such a hothead and refuses to be corrupted, even though, again, you are a jazz musician in the 1950s. Okay, how on earth did you...
It would be more shocking if they came out with a story saying cops raided his place and they couldn't find it reefer anywhere.
Well, precisely. But what ends up happening in this instance is, Sidney decides that he's going to go plant the story. And where is he going to go to it first? Well, the columnist that basically tried to get handsy with Rita, and he shows up at the dinner at the dinner club where that man is eating with his wife. And Sydney's basic approach is that I am basically, you're going to do this thing for me, or your wife's going to suddenly find out what you were up to last night.
Because doesn't he greet him by asking how his wife is doing?
Yeah.
And just the reaction. Because, again, I don't offhandedly know the actor in this scene, but, like, he also plays it similar to Lancaster, where it's, they're very expressive in what they're not saying.
Well, exactly. And Sidney basically invites himself up to the table where the wife is selecting horses to bet on at this point. And Sidney's basically ingratiating himself with her, even though she can kind of tell there's something going on between her husband and him. And when is particularly when Sidney tries to slip him the news item he wants him to place. And,
well, yeah, because the guy, he's in a bind, but he's also not stupid, right? He's like, I know you feed stories to Hunsaker. Why are you giving one to me?
Well, precisely. And what ends up happening from this point is finally, rather than go along with Sidney's plan, he just straight up admits, while trying to mitigate things, and one of those wonderful character details, it's like, well, you know, I was being foolish last night, and, well, there was this girl, and it basically explained to his wife, it's like, you know, explaining, it's like, I can't allow myself to be blackmailed by his type here. And,
yeah, the Letterman approach.
Yeah, and effectively, and his wife's view of it is that, well, you know what? Good for you. I mean, she's clearly disappointed, but her final line is that this is the first clean thing you've done in years. at this point, you know, implying that she is more than well aware of how corrupt her husband's business generally is, for the most part. And they just walk off, making Sydney eat humble pie at that point in time. And things look like the plan's going to backfire until Sydney spots somebody across the room who's basically signaling him to come on over. And this would be yet another New York columnist who is willing to print trash in the these tabloid style for him. And sure enough, him and Sydney get bantering back. And again, much like the previous one, he's not a dummy either, because he knows Sydney wants him to plant the column. He's happy to do something to make Hunsecker look bad if it implicates his sister, but...
Well, he says, you have to give me a reason.
Yeah.
And then we get, it sets up something unsettling, but it's a great line where Sydney then pulls out, like, what is it, the magazine with the cover shot, and he basically starts describing Rita, and then the guy thinks about it for a second and says... I'm not an unreasonable man.
Yeah, and this leads to probably the sleaziest scene in the entire film, which is, like, Sydney...
And, I mean, the reason it's upsetting, because he shows up at Rita's with the muckraker, and I think what makes it even harder to watch is that the way Rita plays the scene, she knows what's up the moment the door opens.
Well, absolutely, and we should note here that it's not her apartment, it's Sydney's apartment. She was there waiting for him to get back at, too. And, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Ugh. Yeah, and basically, Rita wants nothing to do with this, but Sydney basically starts pointing, it's like, look, this guy is willing to help you. He's willing to keep your job. You know, it's like, you asked me for a favor, and now you're getting mad at me about all this. And this guy, again, in the background, he's always talking about, haven't we met before? Haven't we seen somewhere? Oh, let me guess. It was the beach over in wherever there. And she keeps saying, I've never seen you before in my life. And finally, you know, Sydney applies enough pressure, and we learn a lot of things about Rita in the scene, including the fact that she is a single mother putting her kid through boarding school at this point in time, which just makes the scene that much sadder.
Yeah, because it drops, and, like, it's a very quick line, but, you know, it's like in Reservoir Dogs, where we learn nothing about Mr. Orange, but right before the big heist, he goes back and he grabs the ring, and it's just, it's that wrinkle that suddenly, like, wow, okay, there's something else at stake.
Well, absolutely. And in the case here, yeah, we get to, finally, she caves, and she's willing to do, and Sydney basically says, the apartment's yours, I'm out of here, I gotta go.
Have fun, kids. And then she admits, what was it, 2 years ago, Palm Beach?
Yeah, she finally admits that. You can tell whether she's just saying it for the sake of saying it, or whether this is actually something that's happened, but her important thing is, whatever you do, don't tell Sydney. And, yeah, this guy is more than happy to be there. And sure enough, we cut to the next morning, where Sydney's looking in the papers, and sure enough, there's his item planted there for all to see.
And going to his office, sure enough, there's Steve, as well as Frank, right?
Yeah, Uncle Frank and Steve are there, and again, I mean, they're basically there, and Steve is furious, not only because he views it as a smear, but he is 99% sure Sydney would be the one to place that there in this instance. Frank, on the other hand, is trying to more or less keep the peace by saying, now, look, we don't know that. Like you said, we just thought you might have some advice, Sydney. And again, Tony Curtis just eating this scene up, where Sydney is so indignant that they would come to him, even as they're accusing him, even though we all know that that's exactly true at this point in time. And
because he's so good at feigning that indignation of, what, you're in a jam, so you're going to come in here, and you're going to yell at me as if it's my fault when I'm the only person that can help you out of this situation? Is that how you're going to do it? And also plants the idea that, well, I have an idea, let's talk to JJ. And, like, Steve is presented as a very naive character, but you can also see that the way that Curtis relies on his charm through his performance. Like, this is also a moment where it's like, even if it was a more headstrong actor, you could also see how people could get roped into this.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, oh God, it's such a deliciously painted scene, but basically...
Because, yeah, I mean, Steve is completely correct, and he is not unfound. Everything he's pointing out that suggests Sydney may be involved is true and well-founded, and yet we all disregard that because, oh man, Sydney, that guy could sell you Christmas cards in June.
Well, and the big thing about it is that Steve, while he quote-unquote may be the most morally upright individual in this film, he also has no sense of how to play politics in the world he's in.
Yeah. Steve and Susan are really presented as the only two that are outside of that world of shared understanding.
And that's a point that's illustrated when Steve finally agrees to more or less go off and cool off while Sydney looks into things, walks out of the apartment, and then Frank basically turns to Sydney and basically points out, it's like, look, if I told him what I really think about this whole thing, you wouldn't have your head right now. He's basically more or less what he tells him. So it's very clear that Frank totally believes that Sydney's responsible for everything, but he at least knows the game well enough to know that he can't do much about it at this point in time. And sure enough, Steve goes to see JJ and basically explains to him, look, we've got everything exactly where we want it. We need to be careful about this. You need to get him his job back at this other club and basically start promising, you know, agree to meet with him and basically promise that you will help him to clean this thing up, because this kid will not accept that kind of charity from you because of his, you know, hot-headedness. And sure enough, while this is going on, we get a wonderful scene that has nothing to do with the plot of this movie, but it just illustrates the delightfulness of just what a creep Sydney is, where he goes to visit JJ's secretary and starts looking through the morning's print, finds Herbie Trimple, a comedian that JJ's just for the on the whim going to give a boost, just so he can go off, find this guy, and basically say, try and get him as a client that he can boast of there.
Yes.
Yeah, which is, oh God, I know it has nothing to do with the plot of this movie, and I'm still so happy it's there because, my God, is
it's an odd little sidebar, but we do get that great bluff where he calls JJ and we see that it's just the secretary on the phone listening confusedly. Yeah, it's, again, it's one of those moments where we see, like, Sydney, yeah, for all of his faults, he knows how to play the game. And, like, he... regardless of the morality of what he's working for, he clearly wants it more than anybody.
Yeah, absolutely. And this leads, yes, finally to, because in this world, JJ also has a television show that he's about to broadcast. And sure enough, everybody meets up at the studio. And the staging of the scene where we finally get the big confrontation between JJ and Dallas with Tony Curtis in the scene is...
Yeah, because in many ways, like, this is not really the climax of the film, but this kind of feels like the centerpiece scene of the film.
Oh, unmistakably, because as particularly the way McKendrick and Howe shoot this scene, because of the way in which it's framed, we basically have Steve and JJ sizing one another up, and Steve not really able to control his temper and just eat a little bit of humble pie, so that this situation works out, where he comes across as like, fine, I'm willing to play ball with the brother. I'm willing to make good with him for the sake of my fiance here. Instead, we basically see him start laying into JJ, and JJ getting indignant and just watching Sydney behind him at all times.
Well, yeah, because Sydney's presence alone seems to be what starts making things go south, because Steve and JJ are talking like more or less amicably. But then Sydney keeps cracking wise, and then Steve keeps asking JJ why Sydney is there, and then JJ just keeps responding like classic bully style with, does that bother you?
Yeah.
Why does it matter if he's here? And then, like, sort of that just aggressive questioning until it all breaks down.
Well, absolutely. And it leads to, there's a wonderful callback in the scene from the first scene between JJ and Sydney, where in that initial scene, we see JJ ask Sydney to match me, and Sydney refuses at that point in time. All of a sudden,
this is not right now, JJ.
Yeah, and at this point in time, as soon as we get this wonderful shot where it comes in close, we got Burt Lancaster in profile, cigarette in hand, just hanging there, Tony Curtis sitting behind him in the studio audience. just says, "Match me, Sydney." And we just see Tony Curtis, without blinking an eye, light the cigarette, light up the cigarette, and just hang back in that sort of smug look on his face. Oh, it is such a wonderful shot and just a great performance moment.
Well, yeah, but sort of the takeaway is that the two are even more at odds than before. Steve still wants to pursue Susan, and now, like, JJ basically kind of goes off the deep end because he's like, you know what, I'm beyond mad now. And it's even scarier because he doesn't raise his voice at all. And basically, JJ decides, you know what, I'm insulted, so I'm going to have you, Sydney, plant a bunch of marijuana cigarettes in Steve's coat, and then we'll get Kello to arrest him. Problem solved. And then, well, this is what triggers the crisis for Sydney, though. Because he quite rightly points out, it's like, JJ, you are one of the most powerful people in America. Why do you want to destroy this man?
Well, absolutely. And again, this is the big thing, because as far as, you know, Sydney's concerned, everything's done. Everything's worked out the way it is. But for JJ, the way he frames it is in the sense that this guy just basically insulted an American institution that, you know, needs to be protected, and he needs to be shown his place. And yeah, what this leads to Sydney basically starting to point, it's like, look, this is unnecessary. If you do this, you're just going to drive Susan back to him and everything else. And it's like, I won't do this. I won't do anything dirty for you, this dirty. Not even if you gave me a call up. And then he realizes, JJ silently points out to him, it's like, I'm going to go away with Susan for 3 months. We're going to recuperate somewhere. I need somebody to run the column in my absence, Sydney. Who says that person can't be you? And right there, whatever's left of any human dignity that Sydney may or may not have had is completely crushed at this point as he agrees
to go with it. And I mean, it proves what JJ's secretary tells him earlier is true, because he's flirting with her and she says, you know, you're a charming man, Sydney, but you don't have an ounce of respect for anything alive.
Well, precisely. And sure enough, he goes back to the club.
Because without too much of a struggle, he then moves on. He's like, yeah, I mean, I'll do it. This is what I want. And very ipso facto, goes to the club, sneaks some grass in his pocket, has a nod to Kello outside, and then decides to toast his new favorite perfume, right?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I love the shot of Steve exiting the club by himself, walking there with his guitar case in hand, and the way in which Kello and his fellow corrupt cop basically just sort of pin him in. We don't see Steve fight back. We don't see anything. We don't need to see a single thing about what happens to Steve, because this is his exit from the movie. We just know what's going to go down at this point.
Yeah, because afterwards we just hear him as a voice on the phone, right?
At best. I'm not even sure if it's audible what you can really hear him say, but...
Oh, right. We also skipped over, though, that Susan has a brief scene with Steve, though, where they pledge their love. She admits that she doesn't want to run away with him, not because she doesn't love him, but she knows that JJ would try and destroy him. She wants to do the noble thing, fall on the sword.
Well,
which is dumb, but I mean, yeah.
Yeah. The important thing is that, yes, we finally cut back to Sydney, yes, toasting his new favorite perfume, success, in a drunken moment where he is happier than hell in this nightclub / bar. And then lo and behold, Herbie Trimple shows back up, looking, you know, it's like very pleased to have seen his name in JJ's column. And it turns out that JJ, quote unquote, is calling for Sydney to show up, and basically gives
come over immediately.
Yeah.
And then we get that we get that slow walk through the dark apartment.
Well,
and it's a great scene because we know something is up, and it is the space is traveled through in such a way that it gets like the absolute maximum amount of time you can sustain it before you have to reveal something.
Yeah, and basically it's Susan in a seemingly suicidal state. And Sydney realizing, she called me here, why is this? And sure enough, basically chastising her for like, oh, come on, grow up. What do you think was going to happen? I mean, and go on and, you know, understand what kind of world we work in here. And sure enough, she tries to throw herself off the balcony. Sydney stops her, puts her back in the bed, locks the door, but only in enough time as he tries to more or less comfort her to see JJ walk in, who starts making all the wrong assumptions about this. And this gets back to the big thing about JJ in this film where, yeah, this guy, for all of his justifications as to why he wants to protect his sister, it's pretty clear he has incestuous desire towards her.
And I mean, the big symbol is that up until this scene, Susan is only seen wearing this big fur coat.
Yeah.
Which is a gift from JJ and, like, is a figuration of his hold over her.
Yeah.
And also just the idea of, like, the exotic gift of a fur coat. And, you know, there's definitely something beyond mere platonism. And, like, it's never explicitly said, it's not dwelled upon. But I think with the few cues we do get, I think we're supposed to make that inference, too.
Well, absolutely. Like, I mean, it's definitely subtext, but it's on the verge of becoming text in this film, unquestionably.
Yeah. So, I mean, JJ sees it, though, and he goes ballistic, and he starts putting the squeeze on Sydney, and Susan wakes up, and basically everybody has to figure out what story are we going to tell.
Well, basically, and we can't forget that at this point, Sydney basically admits that, who the hell do you think told me to plant the grass on Dallas in the first place? And it's at that point in time, Susan finally has comfort.
Well, because JJ is feigning ignorance, that he... Because he comes in and Sydney explains that he was there because he wanted to talk to him about Steve. JJ Perez, what happened to Steve? I don't know. And he's maintaining the lie, while at the same time, Susan is... Because, what is it? She tries to say that she didn't do anything crazy, or she didn't try to jump either.
Yeah,
right?
Because she's
so
basically...
It's competing lies, and it all gets held up until Sydney gets worked up and says... Yeah, you think I'm against you? Who do you think planted them on Steve in the first place? And it's like, did I say that?
Yeah, and at that point, basically JJ's approach is to call Kello on Sydney, and Sydney's approach is like, well, screw you, I'm out of here. You think this isn't going to see if you can catch me? Leaves the apartment, but not before we see Susan finally, you know, decked out and saying, "I'm leaving you. I'm going to Steve. I want nothing to do with you ever again."
And she's no longer wearing the fur coat.
Exactly. And she takes off, leaving from here. Now, this leads to the delicious final scenes of this movie, where basically, as she's walking out, as daylight hits New York City, she's walking off to presumably a quote-unquote better future, or at least as good, a very, very dull one with...
A guitar player who was just released from jail?
Yes, Sydney getting picked up by Kello and beaten by him on the street there, and...
The last we see of Sydney after, like, his, him sort of facilitating a good outcome... At one point in the film, yeah, it's rewarded by getting beaten up and immediately dropped by two dirty cops.
And, yeah, we see JJ walking out into his balcony in the sort of crestfallen, defeated sense where, yeah, he has lost the one thing that was basically made him vulnerable in this entire situation.
Like in Street Fighter?
Sort of, yeah. But the...
He lost his conscience.
Of course.
Yeah, but it also very, very much echoes the finale to A Face in the Crowd once again, because we see sort of the one who wields the media platform left alone on a balcony staring out as a woman walks out on them. Only here, we don't have screaming, and we also don't have Walter Matthau.
Thank God for not having Walter Matthau rambling on for 5 minutes that needs to be cut off. But the key...
The proletariat will never forgive you for the cowardice of all of your actions hiding behind your yellow journalism.
But the nice thing about this, is what makes it why this is a much more effective ending, particularly beyond the lacking Walter Matthau monologuing for hours on end, is the fact that in this instance, yeah, this is a conclusion. Yeah, our villains have technically gotten just desserts, sort of, but nothing's...
Well, not really, though, yeah. Because JJ faces no meaningful comeuppance at all for any of his actions in the film, other than his sister walking out on him. Yeah. Sydney, he gets beaten up by the cops, but, like, so it's not a good outcome? He's made an enemy of JJ... What? And best case scenario, he still facilitated the non-consensual sexual interaction between Rita and another guy.
Well, absolutely. I'm not saying that this is what I mean. Like, at most, Sidney's probably going to do some form of prison time, whether for planted reasons or because he quote-unquote lied to the cops and planted evidence.
Well, it's a case where even if he was being sent to jail, that's not necessarily a bad thing. So it's a very weird ending because it's like, okay, we have three characters. Only one has kind of a happy fate, and even then she gets the graduate ending. So it's like, yeah, what do you do with that?
But that's what I love about this ending, is that it really is an unresolved ending. None of the central problems or issues has gone away. Like, this is about as pitch black as noir can get in terms of, and this is basically how screwed up your society is. Because what's the answer in this point? There's no smoking gun to get rid of JJ. Fine, you took out Sydney. There's probably going to be another Sydney within weeks, if not already one out there right at that very instant. And yeah, she goes off with Steve Dallas, who at best is now going to be one of those people that everybody treats with suspicion, given what went on and who he's involved with. I mean, honestly, if he's wise, he'll probably move to Texas and become a, you know, country music star, where he would probably fit in better.
Steve Tex Dallas and his all-star cowboy orchestra.
Well, precisely. Like, oh my God, yeah. I mean, I love this movie, but yeah, Dallas, it really is the weak point in this whole thing. But yeah, I mean...
Yeah, but I mean, it's a bold choice to end a film that way. And I mean, like... We, in our historical imaginary, we tend to think that, like, the bummer ending is a totally new invention. And it's like, no, I mean, like, you go back to, like, you know, Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, and there are dark endings in the film. So, again, it's not as facile as, you know, don't like it because it's not happy. It's a strange choice to end the way it does, and it is one that does signal, like, well, we can't pretend that these issues are so neatly closed off, because the whole thing is, they're all people operating within a much bigger system of, like, shadow power and gossip and cultural capital being used as weapons.
Well, precisely, and that to me is why, like, I just, this is such a black-hearted movie, because... Yeah, this is not going to comfort you as you leave the film. At best, you get an ambivalent ending, if you want to describe it like that. At worst, you get basically, yeah, everybody has kind of a bad thing happen to them, but nothing has changed for the better for anybody in these circumstances.
Well, yeah, and like, you and I were talking before the episode about whether or not to think of this film as satire. And I guess The reason why I would say it seems to hit a different register is that it never seems to, like... It never seems... It doesn't offer any kind of, like, actionable outcome through a reading of the text.
Yeah.
In ways that satire typically ends up being a specific message or a suggestion of some kind of different action or intervention. And that's not what we get here. Like, we see the black heart of modern power, and we're not being told anything we can do about it, because there isn't anything.
Well, but that's what I think. I wouldn't use the word satire in this film. I would definitely say noir, more than anything else. Like, this is pitch. Like, outside of the murder mysteries, noir murder mysteries, this is probably the most black-hearted film of that, whether you want to call it mode or subgenre. Because, yeah, this is not about giving you solutions. This is just about letting you know, by the way, while you're living in comfort or in ignorance, this is what's going on around you.
Yeah, this is how the world really operates.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's, it's shady newspaper men and, press guys that never sleep, and people with pasts and secrets, all of them interacting with the celebrity class and the political caste in our nation, and everybody just knows each other.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's all compartmentalized. Like, JJ has that great line where he says, my left hand hasn't known my right hand in 30 years.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the big thing. And I mean, it's hard. I imagine it, particularly in 1957 when this film was released, it'll react in a way, I think audiences would probably react in a very different way from what's an audience now would have. Because as we sort of...
I think there's a much better reception for this film if it were to be released for the first time in 2020 much, much more than it was in 1957.
Well, I think part of the thing is that there's enough distance where, yeah, if you don't know who Walter Winchell is, if you don't know J. Edgar Hoover, you don't know the McCarthyism and the HUAC, a good chunk of this film is going to, you know, I think a lot of the immediate impact that this film would have in 1957 with audiences very much aware of those things, that's not necessarily going to translate in 2020 for an audience that isn't as aware. It might just play more at the surface level without having that deeper subtext to reach him. Because again, you know, it's hard to make that connection. Well, who's Walter Winchell? Who's our contemporary example to match that? Because there's not as direct a link between, I don't know, yeah, Alex Jones and, you know, J.J. Hunsucker.
Well, everybody knows that Alex Jones is a creep anyway.
Yeah.
Let's see. Did Dave Barry get Me Too'd?
Not positive.
I wonder. Yeah. I mean, we don't really have that. And I mean, like, it's also because news has become so stratified. Like, all right, academic cap for a moment. It's almost like this film, in its time and in its context, the idea of a columnist could be more all-purpose than it is now. And whether you look at things like Deadspin closing down because the editors are like, no, stick to sports. And the idea that, oh no, I only do Ukraine affairs for, New York Observer Online. And things like that. Like, it's news has become so specialized in a certain sense, and yet does doing so simply mask the fact that, no, I mean, it's just a big flat circle of moneyed interest being connected with one another, just as it is in this film, and rant. I don't know what I was trying to say with that, but it dawned on
me. Well, I would say that, you know, to build off what you're talking about, I think the key distinction is that the money issue is probably more overt now. As much as it hides in plain sight, like you don't really need to do much to hide the idea of money is influencing the media, or where all that money is coming from, or who's interconnected through what various shady corporations. We're all, you know, even the most ignorant amongst us is probably aware on some level of that. How we choose to deal with it becomes a different issue. Whereas in 1957, I don't want to make the claim that it was somehow easier to hide. But again, you don't necessarily know who's running the newspaper at all points in time. You don't know where who's involved with who, because there's not that all sort of omnipresent surveillance that's going on of culture 24 hours a day, 7 days a week like we have now. So I don't know. I think that might be the difference, where it's easier to pin it on concrete examples like a JJ rather than indict the system, which is where we're kind of at now. More so than anything. But yeah, that was Blake.
On that optimistic and uplifting note.
Yeah.
I mean, Dave, do you have any more thoughts to wrap up The Sweet Smell of Success? Because I'm going to be spending the rest of my day reading the news and just thinking, I wonder how many of these journalists have sisters that they're very protective of.
All I'm going to say is, rather than reading the news, there are a number of wonderful books out there. Doctor Who Scratchman by Tom Baker, yes, the star of the show himself back in the 1970s and early 1980s, is available and well worth your time. Yeah, that was really going nowhere. Point being, there's more cheerful things. Yeah.
But you know what is going somewhere?
What's that?
Our show. To another episode next week. We're going to close off this one proper. I honestly, living under quarantine has made me forget the order I normally do it. So we are going to say adios to Sweet Smell of Success for now, until we come back and we need something else to yell about next year. Dave, why don't you tell all the wonderful people at home where we are going to be going next episode?
Well, next episode, when we may bring back the Hits or Pit segment, the key thing is that we're going to be following director Alexander McKendrick, to The Lady Killers, the 1955 version, not the Coen Brothers film with Tom Hanks. No, this is the one with Alec Guinness, Herbert Lom, and Peter Sellers.
Yes.
Which,
speaking of, yeah, it's beautiful, Dave, actually. We've gone from beginning the episode talking about Coen Brothers films everyone forgets, and we're ending the episode talking about Coen Brothers films everyone seems to forget.
Yes, absolutely. But yes, we are turning our attention to very, very dark British comedy at this point in time.
Decidedly British comedy as well.
Oh, yeah. So, please...
It'll be more chortle-worthy than what we saw this week, I think.
Oh, absolutely. But yeah, so tune in next week when we get to that. Again, don't forget, there are still many wonderful episodes of Film Strips available for you to listen to get through this time if this is your first time listening to us.
Well, yes. So, and in light of that, it's time to turn to our patent-pending bumper segment, Hits and Pits, where David and I celebrate and condemn the little things. So, Dave, what do you want to give your first hit to for Alexander McKenzie's Sweet Smell of Success? McKendrick.
Yeah, there we go. Yes, first one, if it wasn't
already... I dropped my phone.
Yeah. If it wasn't already obvious, in this instance, I'm going to give it to Tony Curtis, because, oh my God, is that performance. Like, this is, like I said, an actor hungry and willing to do anything and everything to prove himself. And my God, does he more than do so here. The fact that people slept on this performance in 57, while understandable, is a damn shame, because the career he could have had from this point forward would have been astounding if he'd been allowed to play these kinds of roles all along. But yeah, like, there's not a line of dialogue in this film that he doesn't eat up. There's not a single moment where the snappy pace and rhythm he brings to it isn't absolutely delightful. Seriously, if nothing else, check it out for his work alone. But what about you, Andrew? What would be?
Yeah, it's definitely, like, it's not the kind of performance where you can tell it's someone that's hoping they'll, that they're, it's not that they think they're bringing an edge to the performance. He's bringing an edge to the performance, and he knows it. I would say my first hit is also, in a weird way, my first pit.
Okay.
And that would be the script, specifically by Clifford Odets, how he retooled it extensively for the screen. Because I think the script is pretty legendary in terms of its dialogue and its quotability. And, I mean, it's written in such a clever way. It does sort of reach that mammoth register where you're so entertained that you kind of forget that nothing is really happening. But, I mean, it carries it along. It's very clever. It's very snappy, eminently quotable. At the same time, I feel like there are some scenes where it kind of slides a little bit further in the sense of watching theater. Just in the sense that... I mean, it goes from very naturalistic dialogue to certain scenes that really stand out as if they were written specifically to be like, no, and this is the big monologue, if you know what I mean. And it feels like those are the moments where the film feels most rigid, where, especially with the cinematography, the music, and the editing, like, there's normally a very smooth, dynamic flow scene by scene. But, I mean, you can't have one without the other in this case. So, one and one from Andrew goes to Clifford Odets' script.
All right, but speaking of cinematography, James Wong Howe, my God, is your work gorgeous in this movie, particularly when you consider that all the exterior scenes in this film were shot on location in New York City, particularly during busy parts of the day. And then likewise, all the interiors were shot on LA sound stages. And I gotta say, the uniform look of this film, you would never know better that these things were shot in completely separate parts. Like, it is seamless. But even putting aside how seamless it is, even shots such as, for example, when we see Steve playing guitar up on stage, notably the camera placement by Howe is staggering, because that's not Milner playing the guitar, because he couldn't do it to save his life. That's another member of the Chico quintet playing for him, but you would never be able to tell because the camera placement is just so that you don't notice that it's not his arm at that point in time. Or just the use of shadow, or the way in which they shoot the close-ups of Burt Lancaster's face to get that extra gleam on through his glasses that he's wearing throughout the film. Like, it is just... There is not a single frame of this film that isn't just painterly.
Wong does a great deal with just Burt Lancaster's glasses in this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, again, the camera movement, just the way, like, it's not flashy in the sense where, I mean, when we get camera, it's nice, it's subtle, but every minute of it works, and it all adds to the tension, to the drama, to the energy of the scenes. And seriously, folks, if you want a master course on how to use on cinematography, you could do worse than studying this film, because this is the real deal here, folks. So I salute him here and highly recommend you check this out, if only for that. What about you, Andrew?
Let's see. I'm going to give my final one to Elmer Bernstein for the score, just because, like, it is perfectly suited to give the film its sort of urban jungle feel. Like, that idea of this is a city that there is always something going, there is something always rising. It moves it along at a tempo that is more than matched by the cinematography. And, yeah, like, Bernstein was a prolific composer, worked from everything from Dirty Dancing to Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, this is a great score. It is not totally dissimilar. And I know we've made a number of comparisons to Quincy Jones's jazz score in Mirage, where, you know, you have, like, sort of that noir jazz hybridization. And, yeah, I mean, I think it really helps cement the film as a uniform piece. I mean, we said a lot of great things about Burt Lancaster already, so I'm going to give the nod to our man Elmer on the sound. So, Dave, I also gave my pit already. I think I know what yours is going to be, but why don't you give it to me?
All right, I'll get the obvious one out of the way. Martin Milner. Here credited as Marty Milner. We should note that for the record.
Party Marty.
Yeah.
They were trying to make him look charismatic.
It's the thing where, you know what? It's not that he's so awful that it sinks the film. He is perfectly serviceable in the role, but there's nothing that he brings to it that makes him stand out, and it works in this film's favor in the sense that Steve is kind of meant to be a lunkhead. Like, he is not the brightest bulb, and there is something very stiff and one-dimensional about him. So it works, but it also means that when you have scenes where he's going up against Lancaster and Curtis and basically everybody else in this movie, he really is, he sticks out like a sore thumb in terms of he can't hit the notes that everybody else is hitting, and it's a darn shame. I'm not necessarily saying Robert Vaughn would have been better, but Robert Vaughn probably would have been better, and probably more believable as a jazz musician in New York City than Martin Milner is.
Yeah. No, I think I'll agree with you there. That's all I really got, other than the fact that, yeah, I mean, maybe not the best Corona viewing right now.
Yeah, I mean,
maybe,
like,
we'll do a spin-off podcast where we only look at films using the COVID scale for quality of film. I'll come back to very good. 10 out of 10. Okay, I'll come up with something, because we've got to adapt with our show, just as each and every one of you at home must adapt as well during difficult times. And in these difficult times, social media is more important than ever, isn't it, Dave?
Sure, why not? You can find me at 24Panels on Twitter. What about you, Andrew? Where can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter at filmstripper.com. Also, no word of a lie, we also endorse Steve Cox for California's 39th Democratic Congressional District. He's running as a third-party candidate. Parties are the problem. Go to voteforcox.com or at RealSteveCox on Twitter to learn more about
it. Let me be very clear about this, folks. He endorses Steve Cox. I, on the other hand, have done zero research into him as a candidate or as a person. I heard about him immediately 10 minutes before we started recording this episode. So look, don't quote me on this one.
I got a real good feeling on this one. And if you go to voteforcox.com, you will have a very good feeling too. You gotta make your own fun during these difficult times. That's what I got up to over the weekend. And I hope that whatever everybody else is getting up to at home, you are being safe, you are being mindful, and you are never too far away from your loved ones. And thankfully, each and every week, we will never be too far away, bringing you new episodes in iTunes or whatever podcasting service you use. And if you wouldn't mind, 5-star reviews help move us up the feature charts and get new eyes and ears on our show. And above all, it's another place to leave some feedback, because Dave and I want to keep bringing you the kind of show that you want to listen to, even when you can't leave the house.
And I would just like to note, if any of you out there know people who don't listen to the show and use Spotify for their podcast, please let them know. I keep looking at our stats every week. We're on Spotify. We're there. Nobody listens to us through it. So I'd like to see those numbers marginally change if we could. You know, I know we got bigger, yeah, more pressing
okay,
issues.
Check us out through Spotify first and foremost, then. If we get 500 downloads this month, we'll get $5 off when we sign up for Tidal. It's okay. I'm in talks with Kanye. I'm really hoping that this Steve Cox thing pans out and we'll go from there.
And on that note, Andrew, do you have any parting words you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Yes, I do, Dave. You gotta spend money to make money. No, remember, everyone, adventure may scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Of course, monotony was the one who put a cat in a bag and then put that bag in the river, and, well, there's no more cats. So just remember who you're going to be sleeping with the fishies next week. Bye.
Hey, sister, are you all alone? I'm standing out your window. Hey, little sister, can I come inside? I want to show you all my love. I want to be the only one. I know you like nobody ever. Little sister, can you find another way? No more living life behind a shadow.